Thank you.
Wait a minute. She wants to talk.
Okay. My apologies.
What are you saying? Not apologize. Yeah. Well,
never.
What are you doing there?
Good afternoon, Senator. Thank you, Chair Bryant and Chair, Vice Chair Courtney. Hi, Bill. Senator Nelson. For the record, I'm Kathy Lowe, State Representative, House District 26. House Bill 3591 creates the crime of interfering or disabling a telephone while somebody's calling for help. This legislation was requested of my office by the Klamath County DA's office, and I passed in your packets. There's a letter from Ed Caleb, the DA there. Attached to the letter, you're going to find some sample police reports that will illustrate this particular problem. Of particular interest in the police reports, you may find a report that says that so vehement was the aggressor's attempt to disable the phone while his partner was calling for help that he bit through the phone wire. Pretty bad. Klamath Falls requests this legislation to address domestic violence cases where the aggressor disables the phone to keep the victim from calling for help. In rural areas, this is of particular concern. Good afternoon, Senator Duncan. Of particular concern because a person in distress has a very long way to go to get to a neighbor. While many district attorneys have policies where they prosecute all the cases of domestic violence, the prosecution is hindered if the victim is not cooperative. And frankly, in domestic violence cases, there are two reasons why a victim may not be cooperative. One is because of the roller coaster nature of domestic violence cycle. They may be in a reconciliation phase. But frankly, the big reason is because they don't testify because they are scared shitless. In this case, if we have this legislation and we make it a crime to disable a phone, at least 20% of the cases in Klamath County, they say that this happens in 20% of their cases, they will be able to go forward because they will have evidence, physical evidence, and they won't necessarily need the testimony of the victim to bring the batterer to justice for at least this crime. And it's especially useful if the victim chooses not to testify. House Bill 3591 is supported by the Oregon State Firefighters, the Oregon State Fire Chief, Oregon State Police Officers Association, the Oregon Governor's Council on Domestic Violence, and the Women's Rights Coalition. I would now like to introduce Sarah Snyder from the Marion County District Attorney's Office. I thank you for your report. If you have any questions of me, I'm more than happy to entertain them now. I do have another committee assignment with your indulgence. I'd like to be excused.
Any questions, Representative Lowe?
Thank you for coming to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Thank you very much for having me, Senator.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
And I would just like to thank my colleague for being here, so I can get to hear your
own people. I already thank you. You don't have to suck up to it.
Hey, we're next door neighbors. Leave them alone.
We are the state Senate.
Thank you, good
sir. You should thank me for taking you out of order, please.
I thank you very much for taking me out of order, and I thank the audience for their patience and indulgence while I did so.
I wish you nice to have a good weekend, but I'm going to reconsider the motion. All right.
Vice Chair Courtney and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Snyder. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County, and I'm here this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. As Representative Lowe mentioned, this is to be a tool to be used by prosecutors in cases where domestic violence clearly has occurred within a home and yet we are unable to prove an assault beyond a reasonable doubt, either because the victim is uncooperative or the victim has fled or the suspect cannot be contacted. This is intended only as an alternative tool. That is how it is used in other states where such legislation exists. And by allowing a suspect or a defendant to plead guilty to this kind of charge, we can still get what I would refer to as domestic violence conditions, which is counseling, parenting classes where appropriate, and no contact with the domestic victim without some kind of waiver. I would be happy to entertain questions. I think Representative Lowe's letter from the district attorney in Klamath Falls, Ed Caleb, represents the Oregon District Attorney's Association position very well, and the two police reports that are attached are very representative of the kinds of cases where we are unable, as the state is unable, to go forward because of a victim's unwillingness to cooperate, and yet we could still prosecute the individual for the domestic violence that clearly has occurred within the home. So I thank you all, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Ingrid?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, Mr. Buskin, members of the committee. I'm with the Ingrid Sosa with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are opposed to this bill for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you'll note in the police report that was provided to you, the phone that was disconnected belonged to the person who the state wished to charge in the matter. So these were individuals who disconnected their own telephone. Secondly, when we talk about enabling a prosecution for disabling your own telephone because you don't have evidence to prove actual injury or any kind of crime with respect to the alleged victim, perhaps you're creating a fence where there doesn't need to be one. Finally, there is a statute which is already in effect. It's ORS 162-235, which is obstructing governmental or judicial administration. The benefit that that's in, it's a Class A misdemeanor like this would be, the benefit of using that statute over the proposed one is that you have to actually interfere with a legitimate effort to contact law enforcement or take an action of that kind. The concern with respect to the proposed language here is that simply for disconnecting your own phone to prevent someone from making a call, a 911 call, doesn't require that the person who was going to make the call had a legitimate purpose to do so. So, for example, if your child repeatedly calls 911 or the fire department or something like that, this statute would literally prevent a parent from interfering with that child dialing 911 or some other person in your household who decides they want to do it, because the statute requires only that you interfere with the making of the report. The existing statute on obstruction of governmental administration, however, it doesn't have that effect because it has to be a legitimate effort to contact a law enforcement agency that's involved. So we would find no need for that statute and recommend that you not.
Thank you. Corey, you have your feel on the bill.
This one, as well as two others, but I'll make my comment on this one very brief.
Okay.
I did not support the bill when it was first passed out on the House side and the opposition on the Catholic Committee, because my concern and frustration is the second section of what you've been hearing about today from the testimony on the first vote forum. My concern on Section 2, and I did support the bill, and it came up with realizing that we were going to have an opportunity to make some modifications. So I do, in fact, support Section 1, which you've heard is definitely normal. Regarding Section 2, what we're being asked to do here is to increase the penalty, which is a mandatory minimum penalty for individuals who use alcohol to minors. My concern is that when you look at the numbers, you find currently that $300 for the first offense, second offense is $1,000, third or subsequent offense is again $1,000 plus no less than 38 in charge. As the bill was passed out of the committee and then out of the House floor, it now would call for a conviction on the first conviction of $600, and then on the second conviction of $1,500, and on the third conviction of $2,000 plus the 30 days. And my concern with this is proportionality as to what is happening with DOI. Driving under influence of toxicants, you may not see penalties that we see normally on first offense of conviction range anywhere from $500 to $700. Second one may be close to $1,200 to $1,000. It seems that if you're going to be holding people accountable, it should be a sanction that's going to be more in line with each other. And I'm not here to advocate for individuals that are providing alcohol and minors in the state of Connecticut. But it does seem like we have a mandatory minimum fine as compared to DUII being discretion in court that the whole fine is not a thing. Now, I want to make sure everyone in the committee that is here understands that these are amendments that were put in the bill. This bill basically started off with the Section 1 Congressman Clemens has been working in Washington, D.C. Section 2, he knows that I would be in opposition to the committee. Of course, I didn't have a whole time of the bill, but we understand that we're coming for this committee and actually
the fines that are proposed by the House version that passed were not in line with other sanctions that we see for other alcohol type of offenses. So that's my testimony for your consideration.
Thank you.
Questions?
Yes, sir.
Senator Turno.
Also, in looking at this bill, you've got the first violation, then you have a second violation, and a third. Well, I don't see any kind of time frame between the first and the third. And let's say you've got a 21-year-old out there in a domestic situation. 15 years later, he's stuck with that third violation. So we're going to make him a $2,000 fine after a 15-year period. I'm a little bit disturbed by that kind of language, if I'm reading this incorrectly.
Mr. Chair and Senator Turno, I would agree with you. The current law is, of course, not the bold print, so the only thing that's going to be changing is what the fine is. So I would say that the current law does not make that discretion as to having some lapse of time. And maybe that, to me, would be even another reason why the fines that you're looking at are, I feel, excessive based on what you currently see through the courts for DUII in comparison.
You don't need to ask the question, do you, Lord and High Counsel?
One question, Michael. What was the title of the statute you mentioned?
That is ORS 162-235.
Oh, it's public hearing. On 3-5. What was it?
9-1.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your testimony. All right. What I want to do here is, Ron, you come up here, Ford, you come up here. Now, Ford, you got two more bills, right?
Yes, sir.
Just Ron, you got one bill?
Two more.
You got two bills.
Right.
Well, right. You have one in public hearing, right?
I.
You know what you're here for, man?
I don't know. I think he's also here. We have a driver's license bill connected to Trilogy or...
Oh, no, that was the other committee.
Here is a public hearing. He has a public hearing, right?
That's right.
What I'd like to do is... Yeah. No, we haven't heard one of your bills initially first, right? Could you please sit down? Corey, would you please sit down?
Yes.
Now, Ron, I don't want to get accused of favoritism here. Is it, you gonna, okay, Floyd, the gentleman that he is, the effectman that he is, it's a per
you. Mr. Chair, he's been in three consecutive sessions, and I've only been in two plus one, so I would defer to the...
Well, the Alamo just referred to you. Please proceed on which one are we going to talk about? We'll open it up again. We opened up again on 27-7, right?
27-7.
I just said that. Representative Sir, thank you. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee, a friendly committee, a committee that welcomes people and is interested in their testimony and treats people with respect. Go ahead.
Please
bring it on,
Clay. Thank God you're back.
Oh, and where are you going, Clay? Don't leave.
I'm not leaving.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, most esteemed High Chair.
She's a vice High Chair.
Excuse me.
Oh, vice High Chair.
Bailing out the chair.
What about the committee?
I wasn't finished. I was trying to think some more accolades for the great arbitrator thou art. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for your record, I'm Ron Centeri, State Representative District 22. House Bill 277, I think, is an important bill. I will defer the majority of my testimony to others who will come behind me on this, but this is a bill that would relieve people in the real estate agency and, licensed realtors from having to report sex offenders in any area that they're working in. Registered sex offenders, it creates a problem because it's the first time that realtors are being asked to report something that has nothing to do with the property that they are actually selling. Registered sex offenders don't have anything to do with real property. And it's also something that will probably change over a period of time. So in the last session, we had a bill that would have asked that realtors be responsible for reporting sex offenders. That bill died. There remained some questions whether that could be asked of realtors beyond that, and so this bill came at the request of the commissioner and discussions that I had with him, asking that that be something that we make a positive statement in the law concerning. And so I'll leave this then for questions from the committee and also for testimony that will follow behind me.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, excuse me. I'm being harassed.
Is this being done because it's conceivable that agents might not know, and you're trying to make sure that they don't have some legal obligation later on for failure to have informed? Is that the purpose behind the legislation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, I think that that would be part of it. I think that what the realtors would say, and the commissioner who will speak for themselves, obviously, but it's rightly people who should be able to respond to that kind of information who have access to accurate information. Realtors don't have access to lead, they don't have access to accurate information other than maybe hearsay from somebody in a neighborhood. That in itself could create a liability if I just simply tell a potential purchaser that I heard this, and it isn't so, we're creating a liability that we don't want to create. We don't want to designate a responsibility to realtors to be responsible for this information when we don't have the ability to gather the information and to pass it on.
Are we in
work session yet?
No. I said public hearing. I nothing with.
Okay. And Ron, you're the only witness on this, I believe.
The real estate commissioner is here and also a member of the real estate.
All right. Let me just look at them. Scott, where are you? You're in favor of this bill? Would you like to submit written testimony? Thank you. And Jenna, you're in favor of this bill? Would you like to submit written testimony? You got anything further to say? I didn't think so. We'll close the public hearing, open the work session then.
What's your problem?
I don't have a problem. I think this is great.
No, this is the way we do things over here.
Mr. Chair, I just want you to know, Representative Senator Courtney, that they do things like this over there too. But
thank you, Senator Brown. Thank you, Senator Brown.
You're welcome.
Where's the job?
One defense here for 2,000 people.
Are you still moving this bill?
I'm I move House Bill 2097 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Discussion?
Just a question. Yes. Chair, I apologize for coming in late. Was there a particular problem that led to this bill? Was there a lawsuit filed?
Mr. Chair, for your verdict, actually, as far as I know, the commissioner may know more, but I don't know that a lawsuit has been filed. In the last session, there was a bill that was introduced that would have required realtors to do this. That bill failed in the process, didn't get a hearing. And there was some remaining concern that with no positive statement of law, that there could be a liability for that. And so we wanted to place a positive statement of law affecting that, and that was at the request of the other real estate agents.
Mr. Chair,
Yes, I agree.
If Representative Kosansky is up here on this bill, is that because you are you?
No, he's not up here on this
bill. Oh.
Chair, Senator Burdick, I cannot leave per the Vice Chair's orders.
Actually, we thought it would take both of us, considering the Vice Chair was holding the gavel.
Would I be out of order, Mr. Chairman, in asking Mr. Representative Kosansky's opinion on this bill?
I voted in support of the bill.
Okay.
Good answer. Thank you. Any other questions? Any objections to the motion? Motion carries. Who would like to carry the bill? Thank you. Senator Carno will be the carrier. Now,
don't thank me, Ron.
Should we go down to Mr. Kosansky?
Yes. Texas. We got Deborah up here, too. You better get her up.
All right, Deborah, please.
You bring her up, regardless of what she's on, you bring her up and have them sit together. So that's the way you do these things.
All right. Are you both here on House Bill 3208?
Just me.
Just you.
The way you can wait in line.
No, that's fine. I'm here at your pleasure.
All right. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3208.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Kapori, and I'm the state representative from House District 18. And I'm here today on behalf of House Bill 3208. which I introduced on behalf of the Boys and Girls Club in Portland. Currently, nonprofit agencies must pay a $15 fee to the state for background checks if they want to do a criminal background check on their volunteers. And I have a letter that you will receive soon from the Boys and Girls Club of Salem saying it cost them in excess of $7,500 last year to do background checks. This is a large burden for many organizations that do a lot of one-on-one work with children, have a lot of volunteers. So I've introduced this bill to allow them to waive the fee, nonprofits to waive the fee if they do background, if they do work with children. That's it. There's no opposition in the House. In the House Judiciary Criminal Committee, there was one no vote on the floor.
Senator Courtney.
Yeah, I'm responsible for this. You can mad at me for this ever because it's my bill on this, but I guess State Police notice is going to come. Right? They know about it, and they know they're going to have to keep the cost and all that. So, I mean, I'm going to vote for the bill, but they know what this means.
Some yes, and I haven't received any opposition.
Yeah, so, okay. I guess I saw somebody here from the Boys of Mississippi, the YMCA.
Correct.
So it involves all the not those kinds of work. Okay.
And just say a shall waive any fee. So that would mean
something better.
Right. The fiscal that we received in the House, the original fiscal was about $46,000. So it's not a huge sum of money, and it's even saving the life of one child.
Right. Well, we want to do the check, that's for sure.
That's for sure.
It's a cost. And the estimated for the biennium was $75,000.
Oh.
We just gave him $1,000,000 for it.
Right. The problem is that some groups are not doing the background checks because they can't afford it. So.
Well, they don't have that. May I ask a question? I should know this. They don't have. They have the option. It's not a May. It's a shell. If I'm not wrong.
It's a
May.
It's a shell.
Isn't it for volunteers?
Oh,
it's May.
Right, volunteers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to do it.
Okay. That's right.
Now, the nonprofit, I advise that if they're dealing with children, that it's mandatory that they do it, just because you open yourself to exposure if you know it. Well, I don't think it doesn't have a social control the way it needs.
It's below 50,000 for what
it has. Mr. Chair, if I could, for the record, for the President's District 40, this bill actually came through our committee, and we looked at that issue, and it was below the threshold that was necessary to be referred to what it needs. And we went directly to the floor.
Okay. Yes. We have a different threshold over here.
Well, I think our threshold is really a good threshold if you want to use that one.
What is your threshold?
50.
Yeah, this comes in on a biennium, like 40-something thousand.
Here's the report.
Mr. Chairman, the committee passed for the cost of a name-based Oregon background check is $15. Therefore, if the department were to conduct 1,000 checks for eligible nonprofit organizations, associated lost revenue would be $15,000. Similarly, if 5,000 checks were conducted, lost revenue would be $75,000. So I guess what they're saying, they're not sure.
That's good.
We're not going to send away from me.
Randy Lewis is here from YMCA Polk County. Randy, where are you? He is in favor of the bill. Do you have written testimony?
Sure.
Would you be offended if we just accepted your written testimony, passed the bill out, do pass?
You want to take a chance?
You want to take a chance to testify? All right. With that, so we'll close the public hearing.
I'm the House Bill 3208. To the floor, do pass recommendation. I want to be the carrier.
All right, that might violate the Armada decision. We have two motions in one, but we'll risk it here. Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3208 to the floor and with the proviso that he be the carrier. Any discussion? Hearing no objection, so ordered. Thank you, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, well, it was huge because it was in the motion. Now, boy, can we go, boys, no?
I've been, go to the Alamo.
All right. What is your bill?
Mr. Chair, I actually have two bills. Right. If I could take up the first one, of HB 2853.
We'll open the public hearing on HB 2853.
Very briefly, this bill, Mr. Chair and committee members, is to correct a misunderstanding that appears to be in the interpretation of when police officers are able to go into court and represent the governmental entities. The issue arose when a police officer in one of the jurisdictions that I helped represent was cited into the state bar for possible unlawful practice of law. And the statute says that where
A person is charged with a offense that is non-criminal, meaning a traffic violation or a non-criminal violation. The state or the county or the city are not able to bring in their own prosecutor or attorney to represent that entity unless the defendant is also represented by a defense attorney. And so the situation is we want to make sure the record is very clear because every jurisdiction that I know of in this state has their officers representing them, and we want to make sure that they do not have unlawful bar complaints filed against them. After the bill was filed, I did have a conversation with the state bar. They asked us to modify part of Section 1, which we did, and it was passed out. And for the record and for your information, we inserted the language that's found on line 5 and 6 between the commas, starting with whether created by ordinance or statute in which a city attorney or a district attorney is barred from appearing by statute. Then it goes on that the police officer who is issued may go forward. This is standard operating procedure. It's been going on for decades. I intentionally explained to the young person that called me regarding the bar complaints. And I said that we'll just make it clarify it in the statute to make sure we don't have this problem in the future. And the proposal that's before you are the model rules that are used by the Department of Justice for agencies that have their employee represent them in agency hearings.
Are there questions?
You know, I got one.
Senator Courtney.
If I present a patient all right, Mr. Governor, she spoke to the aide. Is she going to be all right if you recommend you some due process on this?
I think it'll be fine.
Okay. Other questions?
Hearing none, then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2853.
Move House Bill 28534 be passed.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2853. Oh, wait, we have a conflict amendment.
Uh-oh.
Senator Courtney withdraws that motion and instead moves the dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2853. Discussion? Objection?
What is
it? It's a conflict amendment.
Oh, conflict. Okay, excuse me. Thank you.
Objection so ordered. Then Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2853 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Did you like carry this since you two bonded again?
Oh.
That was hurtful. I'll do whatever you want me to do with those things.
Why don't we have Senator Courtney carry this bill?
And I know he'll do a fine job.
He would work. If you have some questions you'd like us to ask him, I can get those too. We'll be happy to do it.
They'll be in the mayonnaise jar.
Thank you. We'll now go to a public hearing on House Bill 3012 and invite Representative Sinceri. Oh, you had a second bill, didn't you?
I did.
All right.
I can stand by if you'd like for me to do that.
Okay, come forward since I've already counted the gavel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Sinceri, Senate District 22. Senate Bill 30, or correctly, House Bill 3012 is a bill, and I'll just go right to this. There are amendments that really leave this bill simply with the task force. I believe, without being positive, that the bill that the Senate sent over to the House that went through the Education Committee and passed and is due to be on the floor this next week will probably pass the House. And it duplicates this bill considerably without the task force. So what we would like to do is just utilize these amendments that you have in the A3s, make a task force available, which would have to go to Ways and Means, and develop it.
Okay. If you recall, committee, this is a bill that was initially different than House or Senate Bill 887, which was substantially different in the way the House amended it from what the Senate did. That bill will have to come back for concurrence at some point, so the debate on 887 will take place later. So by adopting these amendments, what it leaves then is the task force on firearm safety, which goes to Ways and Means, and we'll have to struggle with the other financial needs as to whether or not it can be funded. Yeah,
Representative, as I work through the amendments, they still include consideration of the course required to demonstrate competency with a handgun necessary to obtain a concealed handgun license.
as long as it remains, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, as long as it remains in the task force portion of that bill, okay. Yes, it would remain.
I expressed concern over this issue when the bill was written. I believe we should be developing an abstinence-based approach with concealed weapons, particularly with regard to people under the age of 18, so that is my concern.
Mr. Chair, I won't go into a long discussion about that, but I think the absence is going to be an impossibility because those items in question will probably never be out of reach of people. And to develop some kind of an understanding would create a healthy position rather than an ignorance that could create a disaster.
Mr. Chair, can I ask another question? So how is that different than sex education?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I think it would be self-restraint.
Okay.
And I think that education also is beneficial with sex education. As long as you're not teaching people how to do it, you're teaching them what the result is. There's a vast difference.
Okay. Thank you.
What we're referring to are the A3 amendments, which delete the first two sections of the bill. I would like to point out that probably when 887 comes back, we should consider the adoption of subsection 3 on this bill, which allows a parent or legal guardian to opt out if they want to, and I think that's an important consideration.
That means, Mr. Chair, that we're going to move not to concur when it comes back, just so everybody knows. At least that's what
right.
I would ask.
We
would be agreeable with that.
Okay. And the key there is that came from the Education Committee. So the person that you need to talk to is Senator Harding.
Correct. Yes, you're right.
So otherwise, I will bring it to the committee's attention.
It will come here. It'll go to conference.
It would go to conference, but it first goes to Senator Hartung on whether or not the recommended concurrence. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I just had a question. The intent of the education system for the younger kids is clearly abstinence. Clearly, you know, find a gun, you stay away from it. But through the handgun training that you mentioned here, and just through the general tone, you know, you're dealing with older kids. Is it fair to say that the focus of this interim committee's activity is to teach kids how to use firearms safely as opposed to the importance of staying away from them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burke, for the record, I'm Rod Hardy with NRA. That would not appear to us, or was never the intent, that we would be teaching them the use of firearms. We believe that if you don't want someone to drown, you teach them how to swim. If you expose some people to firearms, you take away this mystique or whatever it may be, and encourage them not to use firearms inappropriately, not so much as to how to use them, but under what circumstances you would say to your peer, what you're doing with this gun that you just picked up is not socially acceptable. Put it down. I'm leaving. We can't tell kids when they get to the age of the seventh grade just to stop and leave. That's not going to happen. We have to be realistic about that. What we envision is a program where peer pressure would make it socially unacceptable to inappropriately handle or use a firearm.
Mr. Chairman, to follow up.
Yes,
again, would it be fair to say, I'm looking at this on line 22 on page 2, it says, and again, this is May, I understand it's discretionary, a senior course of the test required to demonstrate the competency with a handgun. How can you not say that that isn't used?
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment on that, Senator Burdick. A lot of what takes place in the concealed handgun courses has anything to do with shooting a gun. It has to do with how to hold a gun, how to carry a gun safely. It has to do with the mechanics of what makes a gun shoot. There are many young people that have no idea what the firing pin does and how it strikes a primer. And this kind of basic general education about a firearm is very helpful in breaking down the mystique of doing, or if they then come across a firearm, if they were to pick it up, they know what not to do.
So there's much more here than trying to make a person capable of shooting at a target or firing a gun in itself. To get through that course, you've got to go through a whole number of things that have nothing to do with actually shooting a gun or learning how to become confident with shooting accurately.
This is Sherry, to follow up with one last question. But it was your intent that this task force recommendation, when they came by, that this would be included in the mandate as to education, so that you have the mandate for the younger kids, and then the task force would, of course, would produce their recommendation, that too would be mandated. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burke, when we read the bill, it very clearly states that the task force will report back to the legislature during the next legislative session. There is nothing in this bill that mandates, that says that the task force will mandate anything. At least there's nothing in there that I read where it says that. The task force makes a recommendation, the legislature can either accept it or not accept it, or accept part of it, or amend it, or do whatever. This is a group that's put together, and I think it's very well constructed. People from public education, from the medical community, from law enforcement, and I think that we have to trust them to make the proper decisions as to recommendations. There's nothing in here that I see that mandates anything.
Sure, I just have one tiny little question. I don't see a fiscal here, and I'm just wondering how much this task force is going to cost.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have a fiscal in front of me either. The latest figure I have heard was $80,000 for the task force.
Mr. Chair, I guess I have a concern. I'm constantly seeing mandates or pushing different things into the curriculum. I don't think the legislature Assembly should be involved in that kind of a process. I look at this particular one, I think this is fine. If a local school district wanted to adopt this particular brochure and to send out with students and talk about the safety factors, I'm all for it. But to appoint an interim study to deal with this aspect of a program dealing with schools, you know, where do you stop? I mean, I'm getting tired of hearing the public schools racked constantly because they aren't doing this and that, and yet we want them to constantly do more. And it's got to get someplace. So I have trouble with this.
Thank you.
And I'm not opposed to it. And somebody at the local school board wants to do it. More power to them, and I would support them. But the legislative assembly should not be getting involved.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash H amendments to House Bill A and goes 312.
Senator Courtney moves the dash H amendments to House Bill 3012, which deletes the first two sections of the bill. Discussion? Objection? Or?
Chair,
no.
On the amendment?
No.
Even on the amendment?
Don't
forget. I don't want to be in
tune study.
Well, we don't need
to do this. Okay, I'll vote for the
amendment. House Bill, I think it goes 312 is amended to Ways and Means.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3012 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman, yes. I just would like to have some discussion. I think it's late in the session, and I think the later it gets in the session, the more we start talking to ourselves and the people in this building, and the less we are paying attention to what's going out in the real world. And the fact of the matter is that we have had some real tragedies out there in the real world regarding school children in this age group with guns. And for us to be passing a measure, even indicating that we are receptive to training children how to use handguns in school at state offense, to me is highly offensive. I'm going to be a very strong no on this bill, and I hope my colleagues will join me in voting no.
So we have two no's, Senator Duncan and Senator Burdick. Anyone else? Hearing none, motion carries. It goes away from me. Ms. Rozanski, or Representative Rozanski, your next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3189.
We will then open a public hearing on House Bill 3189.
Mr. Chair, I have coming up with me Ann Fisson, who was the Judicial Department. She and I have been working with this bill since I have introduced it. Being handed out to all committee members now is a proposed amendment for the from the Judicial Department's Hand and Gross.
Basically, you'll see changes in two lines of the existing bill, on Section 1, Line 4, as well as Section 3, Line 14. Basically, what this bill is attempting to do is that we have individuals, our situation is in municipal courts as well as judiciary courts where they are not courts of record. And because they are not courts of record, an individual, when they go through a trial in those courts, have a right to what's known as a de novo hearing, which is actually a second trial. In other words, an individual who's found guilty at the lower court, because it's not a court of record, they have the right to have that case retried a second time in front of a court of record. We now have had consolidation of the district and the circuit court, and so these cases are now being appealed for a new separate trial as if the first one never occurred into circuit court. My concern, I would have to say my frustration, is from the perspective of being a prosecutor, is that once the city or the county has proven one of these cases in a court that is not a court of record, they basically have to start all over and do it a second time. It seems to me that that's not fair to the system to allow a defendant to have two shots at a jury trial and then still have the right to appeal on the limited appeal to the Court of Appeals. And so what we're proposing to do, and because of the concern of the impact on the court system, and through the engrossment amendments, would be to limit this kind of as a test program for municipal or justice courts who want to become, in other words, they are not mandated, it is voluntarily, based on the county's decision or the city's decision, to turn their courts into courts of record. If they are 50 miles away from their county seat courthouse, that they would be able to sit as a court of record. They would have to comply with all the rules and restrictions and guidelines that any other court of record in the state, and if they do so, the defendant would have their day in court the first time as if they were being tried in circuit court, and then they would be able to appeal the decision similar to to anyone that is appealing a decision from a court of record to the Court of Appeals. That's the summary of what we're attempting to do, and as I said, this is has a very small impact because the vast majority of municipal courts as well as justice courts in this state are within the 50-mile range, and this would be an opportunity for the court system to see how this works and determine whether or not this is something in the future that they may want to do on a broader basis. And if I could have Ms. Christian give her perspective as to what the judicial department has looked at, I would appreciate that.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Ann Christian. I am Director of Indigent Defense Services Division. Today, however, I'm before the Committee on House Bill 3189A and growth with the Judicial Department, hand in growth, and I apologize for that proposed amendment. I'm here on behalf of the Judicial Department and also as staff to the Chief Justice's Criminal Justice Advisory Committee. It's a statewide committee. House Bill 3189, in its original version and in its Andros version, briefly caused the Judicial Department, specifically the Court of Appeals, concerns about the potential impact on the Court of Appeals as far as new appeals potentially coming to that court. The State Criminal Justice Advisory Committee likely, and it will be considering this recommendation at its next June 10 meeting, during the interim will be looking at many issues, including the issue of muni and justice courts being courts of record or not courts of record and appeals therefrom during the interim. And the proposed amendments are a proposed pilot or compromise that we've been addressing with the good Representative Pisanski. I agree with everything he said. It would limit the Judicial Department's potential risk as far as the number of direct appeals that come to the Court of Appeals, which involves panels of three judges, as opposed to the current system, which allows, as Representative Pisanski has indicated, a de novo, full-blown trial with one circuit court judge and the potential for a direct appeal to the Court of Appeals. Otherwise, I have nothing additional to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Judge Lundhouse is here, and will be able to tell you some of the significant policy issues that I think everyone who's been involved with this bill agrees are out there, and that's part of the reason why, at least as staff to the State Criminal Justice Advisory Committee and the Dale Chen, who is a subcommittee chair of that committee, that we will be hopefully looking at many of these issues involving municipal and justice courts during the interim.
Why don't we have the judge come forward? Thank you. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Chad Lemhouse, Justice of the Peace for Linn County District 4, located in Harrisburg. I'm coming before the committee to offer testimony in favor of, I should say, on House Bill 3189. There are basically four issues that I wish to raise. First, I want to commend Representative Torzanski for his willingness to address issues that affect justice and municipal courts. This is not the only bill that Representative Torzanski has presented to the legislature in this session that deals with these important issues, at least for justice of the peace and municipal court judges. And so I want to commend Representative Krasinski for his taking an active interest in our court business. Second, there's a technical amendment that I think you might want to consider to Section 4 of the bill. The last sentence of Section 4 says that any justice of the peace or municipal judge elected after the effective date of the ordinance must, as a qualification for office, be a member of the bar. You want to consider that municipal judges in almost every case except one or two in the state of Oregon are appointed and not elected. And so what I suggest you do is add the phrase elected or appointed.
And could you point out that again?
That's on line one of page two. It says justice of the peace or municipal judge elected. And I would suggest that you insert or appointed after the effective date of the ordinance. And that would, because justices of the peace typically are appointed by the governor and then elected, that would cover the interim period after appointment before a justice of the peace becomes an elected official. And because most municipal judges are appointed officials by the city council, then this language would pertain directly to them as well. The third item I'd like to bring to your attention, actually the third and fourth item, are policy choices that I want to make sure that the committee understands that it's addressing. First, the number of courts that are going to be actually eligible to participate as courts of record under the bill are limited in number, and there's actually probably only two courts, the Reeves Court, Justice Court, and the Florence Municipal Court that would very likely participate. That's assuming the county commissioners in Douglas County and the city council in the city of Florence agreed to make a court of record of their courts. The reason for those two courts being the only courts affected is because of the geographical limitation and the fact that those two courts are the only courts that would be eligible that presently have attorney judges. And so that's one of the policy choices by enacting this statute, is that you're limiting the number of courts of record that could be created under this bill to a very few and probably only two in actual number. And I think Representative Krasinski and Ms. Christian amply explained the reason for making that policy choice. And that is the concern that if we had some large number, especially of the large city municipal courts that became courts of record, then there would be a substantial number of appeals from those courts of record that would come directly to the Court of Appeals. And that would certainly drastically affect how they do business. The other policy choice that I think the committee needs to consider is that because the appeals are going to be processed through these courts of record in the same fashion as an appeal from circuit court under Chapter 138 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, that includes ORS 138.500, which deals with the payment of indigent defense counsel and costs on appeal for indigent defendants. Basically, those costs are borne by the state court administrator. And so there's a policy choice there, too. It's a funding choice, and again, I think that although the representative and Ms. Christian didn't directly address those, that particular issue, the funding issue, is one that has to be considered from a long-term standpoint if we're going to have justice court and municipal courts become courts of record. And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I'll answer any questions that you may have.
Why, do you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, regarding the cost for indigent defense, it's my understanding from my practice the cities are on the hooks for their local trials that they would be having, and that the state would not be obligated any greater under this bill than they currently are. If you actually did have someone of the indigent defense that was doing a direct appeal to the Court of Appeals, they would have already been into the state system because they would have been in the circuit court and would have been appointed counsel there. And the cost for the city when there's an appeal that goes up is always, or has been in the past, handled by the Department of Justice. And so I don't think that there would be a direct impact at this point, because the local jurisdictions would still be on the hook, because the original trial that they have already appointed counsel would still be the same place as a court of record.
Yes, Senator Kearney.
We're not going to get into a justice of peace policy, are we?
That way.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I mean, recently we had a problem where we had had to have a justice of peace at all claims department, and we had the two courts address this. I just want to be sure that we're not going to, in some cases, the city court is just not, I don't know. I'm just surprised. I don't know.
I think if we, in the sense of to then sitting in, as one court for both jurisdictions, that should not be a problem, because my understanding is the courts that are doing that, it's a contractual agreement that's provided through another statute, and for these courts to become courts of record, their local governmental entity, be it the commissioners or the city council, are going to have to make that determination.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it's conceivable you could have a justice of the peace who is not a
court of record.
Court of record.
That's correct.
Okay, so this doesn't eliminate small communities for the adjustment of fees.
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, what it would require is as the justice of the peace, the county commissioners would have to make a affirmative decision to make that court a court of record, and then they would be obligated with any requirements under operation of a court of record. And it would not remove the court from where it's at as to and what their authority would be. Now, I will say one thing, if I could, Mr. Chair. If a court does become a court of record, a non-court of record, make that shift, one of the requirements would be that the individual sitting as a judge would have to be a licensed attorney. That was a suggestion that came from the city of Beaverton when we put out the original bill and got feedback on it. And I believe they probably have I believe there could be a potential claim if you did not have a trained lawyer trained individual as a judge sitting in a court of record making these type of decisions. And that's what I think is why you have that right to go to a court of record from a court that currently is not of record.
And a county or city won't do that without careful consideration, also because of the costing.
That's right.
When you make it a court of record, you then have to guarantee the not only that it's going to be run constitutionally, but there's a dozen other factors that are involved, and they all cost money.
So a small community could still have a justice of the peace who's not a member of the bar, who does traffic violations and things like that.
Right. This is optional, and you could basically have a dual process for the unit. As the good sheriff said, there's going to have to be a conscious decision, because there is going to be costs to the local communities to make that that change.
I think this was the same thing that there was.
At one point. Right. He wants to make sure it's optional.
Correct.
Other questions? Committee, we have an option, and I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3189, a work session. Do we want to suspend the rules to adopt the changes that are delineated, or do you want to bring it back?
Well, you told us privately.
I'm glad you're saying that
way. That our workload is horrendous. Did you not say that to me many times?
Yeah,
partly?
We have enough bills to keep us here through July.
Okay. If that's the case, then I think we suspend the rules and we're going to move it. Let's just move it.
Senator Courtney moves that we suspend the rules as it relates to House Bill 3189. Discussion, objection, forward. The chair then would make, I'm looking at the hand and growth bill, would make one further interlineation on page 2, line 1, after the word elected and before the word after, say, or appointed. Is there objection to that interlineation? Discussion, hearing none, supported then. The chair would move House Bill 3189 with hand and growth hand amended to the floor due task. Discussion, objection, supported. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Who would like to carry?
Thank you, Senator.
I will help Representative Kozanski out.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. Let me see. Okay, where is
the... I saw Whit walking in.
All right. The
reason I'm glad we'll have Bill for July is because unlike everybody else in this building, he'll be sitting around twiddling his thumb.
Right.
Bill, we have work to do while we're waiting.
We certainly will. Let me do this because I'll clear most of the room so the people can begin and enjoying their... Memorial Day weekend. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1205.
Good.
And you have before you the Dash 7 amendments and an explanation. Let me talk for a moment. And Ann is here also. Since we last met and discussed this, we've had a serious work group, and we've further reduced the bill in certain respects. It retains the important aspect that if the spill is in the state of Oregon, then from a public policy standpoint, Oregon law will control, and that voluntary cleanup and consent orders will be a triggering event where you can make the claim on the policy. But what the Dash 7s do is they correct some typographical type errors. They delete all references to third parties, which, if you recall, was an objection from the insurance company. We've modified the legislative findings from a 4 to 3 paragraphs. It's been reduced to 1, and the parties have agreed to that language. We deleted joint and several liability, which also was a concern of the insurance company. We also deleted the section that talked about vertical exhaustion of excess coverage, which was a concern of the insurance company. There is one further deletion on page 1, line 10, where the earlier we were going to delete for personal injury to others and instead put trespass or nuisance, that now will be deleted also, and will be deleted with this understanding that if you have air pollution and particles fall on the next property next door, that, for instance, would be included in a property damage type claim. On the issue of the attorney fees, we have not reached consensus on that, and I've agreed to continue to work with the parties on that together with Representative Shetterly and Representative Williams. The Speaker of the House has agreed to reopen the Senate Civil Judiciary Committee once this bill passes so that they can consider the bill, and my hope is that we'll be able to reach consensus on the attorney fee language, too. But that's where we are today. Senator Brown.
So are you wanting to move the Dash 7 amendments and hold the bill until the attorney fees provisions work out, or you want to adopt the Dash 7 to move it out of here?
I want to move it out.
Okay.
My goal is we're going to have to... the President thought that the candidates are already for 2 weeks working on Senate bills and would prefer us to move the Senate bills out and just concentrate on House bills.
Move the desk on the amendment, Chair?
Yes, I hear.
There are 4 actual conceptual amendments to make to the bill.
Okay.
Which are relatively minor. Don't make it go through those.
Why don't you walk through those if you would?
Page 1 of the handbook, so you have that attached to your document. Page 1 of the handbook, so line 7, after the period, which is after 2, insert the word only. And these conceptuals are noted on the margin of the answer. Again, as the chair indicated on line 10 of page 1, delete a comma after damage through the word other.
Good reading, Kristen.
Correct. On page 2, just to point out in line 12, there at the end of orders, I did not write that kind of gross bill, although we are using the Dash 7 amendment. Something in the section called a purpose of our class. More rules governing the law determination, like what's here outside the state board. That clarification is in the Dash 7 amendment. On page. Also on page 2, on line 31 before voluntary inclusion dates were written, and on line 34 before direction inserts the word written. And I didn't hear one on line 32 to be directed.
Committee, I was just advised by Mr. Taylor that the House, Speaker of the House has extended the House Civil Committee and the House Criminal Judiciary Committee for an additional week. So all those who have bills pending in those committees will not have to have a heart attack.
You don't care about my heart at all, do you?
Well, on civil, apparently it's open just for specific bills.
That'd be
a criminal should just work up
to get my dog a cat bill.
Is that a criminal or civil?
It's a civil bill.
Oh, you're okay then.
It came out of this city, me.
I remember. Now, then, before Senator Brown makes her motion, we again need to suspend the rules because of the conceptual changes mentioned by counsel and also the motion that I did. Committee, if you're uncomfortable in suspending the rules to do this, I understand, and we can bring it back as printed.
No, I'm comfortable.
Okay. If not, then the rules are suspended, and then Senator Brown moves the...
I don't believe in letting rules get in my way.
The dash seven, remember that. The dash seven with the conceptual amendments discussed and explained by the chair and
It's still not sitting together. You know what I'm saying? You know, the only thing is over here and piled over here. You know what I'm saying?
Is there any further discussion?
If I'm piled, it's going to be good.
Can I approach?
Yes, you may.
Wait a minute.
Approach the bench.
Oh, yes, you are.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
that's...
All right.
There is going to be public. Don't worry about the public record on this bill. Just speak up there and go to the public in the archives, pal.
We have one other
contract for local meetings, Paul. This can go on all. What the heck?
Mr. Chairman, page 3 of the Gas 7 Amendment, line 2 of the Gas 7 Amendment. Line 30, we are deleting the cost of, and then on line 31, depositions and cost of
expert witnesses.
Right.
Some legal or comedy for that.
Yes.
Right.
And talking about the fees, we're not talking about the cost of depositions.
So that is also included in the conceptual amendment. Discussion.
Thank you.
I appreciate the work group. I hope we don't have to spend much more quality time together as we resolve our last difference on this. And are there objections? Hearing that it's awarded, then the chair would move Senate Bill 1205 as amended to the floor to do pass. Discussion? Objection? Ordered. I will carry. And everyone in that group have a good weekend. We'll now open the public hearing on House Bill. Representative Rich, just to make sure, what bill is it?
It's Bill
3361. I call Representative Witt forward. Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Judiciary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And, Mr. Chairman, thank you for scheduling this hearing on House Bill 3361. I introduced this bill on behalf of a constituent of mine who contacted me back in January who had a very specific problem. Namely, this constituent is disabled, unable to work, and gets Social Security payments for his disability. Some of those payments flow to his children because of his inability to work. Yet he has not been getting an offset in terms of those Social Security payments to his children from his child support. And consequently, since he's unable to work, he's not able to afford very much in terms of child support payments. What this bill was designed to do was provide some significant relief to have those Social Security benefits that are a result of his disability be recognized as what should be part of his child support. The bill initially did that. It got amended in the House to go into a formula approach, and the formula does not provide a direct offset. And it passed the House. We knew there were a couple problems with it as it passed the House, but we figured the best thing to do at that point was to address those problems in the Senate. While this bill was moving, I then was approached by another gentleman who is in a similar situation, is disabled and has veterans benefits that flow through to the children. And it seemed to me that the same argument would apply to veterans benefits. So we have brought forth some amendments to this bill that will address that to provide a direct offset for both those Social Security payments and for the veterans benefits. I think those are the dash two amendments, Mr. Chairman.
I have the dash three. And let us see if we have the dash two. Do you have the dash two?
I do.
And we can make copies very quickly.
So right here.
All right. Thank you. I imagine the dash two are the portion that adds the veterans benefits.
Yes. It adds the veterans benefits, and it also deals with the, it reinserts the language in terms of an offset, in terms of the Social Security payments that are a result of the disability.
I don't know if you're planning to move the dash two amendments regarding veterans benefits, but I'd like to hear from SCG. My understanding that they've done some legal research through their assistant affecting Fogarty's here in the room to address that issue. I just have some concerns about adding veterans benefits before we actually do it.
Okay. We'll invite them to testify. We also have the attorney for the Department of Justice who represents SCG. Are there questions for Representative Gray?
Mr. Chairman, I do have Mr. Hoyman here, who's from Marion County, who would like to give some testimony in this point, and Mr. Roach, who is my constituent, who is the individual that initially got me looking into this matter.
Please have them come forward.
Okay.
As they're coming forward, Kathy, if you could, on 1205, without objection, record Senator Duncan as an I vote. Without objection, so ordered. Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Judiciary.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Who would like to go first? You want me to go first? Do you want to go first?
I'd like to go first. I'm nervous. I want to give this up. Tell you what I think. I do have some, Mr. Chair, I do have some copies of a letter I had written regarding this bill. I'm not sure that there's any direct advantage to me to testify, except that I get to say what I think, which is fun.
Well, please do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Holly Sanborn, and I'm a disabled parent, single parent, sole supporter of a 12-year-old girl. As a result of the illnesses and injuries that brought about my disability, I had to, at one point, apply for OHP, which sent the state on a hunt for my daughter's father, and they found him. So that's how we have a support order from someone I never thought to see or hear from again. What I would like to say about the Social Security benefits that my daughter receives as a result of my disability is sort of pursuant to, well, I want to start with my work history as it relates to my payments of my disability insurance premiums. Basically, I started at 16, gluing Christmas cards into a Christmas card catalog on a factory assembly line, and worked as a secretary, worked as a through college. It took me 7 years to get my degree in nursing, but I worked through that. Each hour I worked, all the overtime I worked once I graduated. Thank you, TriMouth. And my voice is shaking, I know.
If I had to face this committee, I'd shake too. So.
Well, actually, you guys are very sweet. It's just my just my tendency to work up. So basically, what I'm trying to say is that I've worked hard as long as I could. And when I first was disabled and wanted to work in the hospital, I went into home health nursing. I was blindsided by a driver who ran a red light. Anyway, it's been one thing after another, but as I worked, I paid Social Security and disability insurance premiums. Now, because I'm a parent, I get not only the premium or the payments to support myself, I get a separate set of monies, not related to my income, specifically for my daughter. If I did not have a child, I would not receive those benefits. Those benefits are to support my child. That is the purpose of the program. That is what the monies are for. To construe them as anything else is blatantly wrong, in my opinion. That's what they are. So, and they're also clearly for the support of the child on behalf of the disabled parent, not on behalf of any other person, but on behalf of the disabled parents who paid those premiums as they worked. My income, which used to approach $40,000 before I couldn't work anymore, is now $1,086 a month. According to the scale, the Department of Justice scale of basic child support obligations, that would put my child support obligation at $115 a month. My Social Security disability benefits that go to her are $543, which are about 473% of my obligation under this law. No, I can't. I can't relax. So, just, I'm having fun, even though I'm really nervous. So, if I could relax, I would. Her father, after 12 years of doing nothing, has been ordered to pay $147 a month for her support.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I'm just curious, did you get retroactive support if you didn't pay for 12 years?
No, that was not addressed. When the Department of Justice pursued my case, they did not consult me in any way. They did not talk to me about the fact that I had no medical insurance. Excuse me. That I had no medical insurance. So my medical expenses for congestive heart failure, for cancer, oral chemotherapy, for asthma, for a cyst in my knee, for a herniated disc in my neck, are not covered.
Okay.
And so basically I'm not getting any.
But,
and so that wasn't considered.
Okay.
And I was never consulted.
All right. But my recollection of Oregon law regarding paternity is that the agency has the ability to go back and get the non-paying parent support from the date the child is born.
Are you saying that did not happen either?
That did not happen.
Nobody brought anything like that up. And now I'm having to deal with this person in my life who's a stranger. I have no idea what his influence on my daughter will be. And, but that's not pursuant to this case, but thank you for asking. There are a lot of many injustices.
Yes, it is.
Yes,
visitation rights.
Pardon?
Yes, visitation rights and so forth now.
Presumably, I don't have the money. I don't know. I have no lawyer. When I get information, excuse me,
In order to have visitation rights, he'd have to find a person. And if for some reason he felt it would be improper, especially with the lack of contact with your child, you could deny the visitation. If he still persisted, then it would be up to a court to determine whether or not there should be visitation and on what basis.
Well, I can't afford a lawyer, so I don't know any of that. And he's scheduled to come and visit. And I have no idea what my rights are.
I suggest you talk to legal aid before that takes place.
I make too much to qualify for legal aid.
Well, I contact your local bar association, and you can finally find an attorney who handles this type of work who would probably be sympathetic.
That would be nice. Thank you for your interest, Mr. Chair.
You bet.
Basically, I think as far as the Senate bill goes and the child support goes, I believe that I've said everything that I do need to say about it. I just wanted to make one comment on page 14 under the commentary.
So you're referring to page 14?
Oh, so sorry. Page 14 of the certificate order for filing permanent administrative rules with the Secretary of State, filed January 15th. Regarding ARS 13705004 05.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think she's referring to the Oregon support guidelines.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Oh, it's being kept out.
What page is that?
That was page 14. And I'm sure the Department of Justice is doing the very best job that it can, but the communication from them has been difficult. I get photocopies of court orders from the L.A. County Court. And those photocopies are terse legal statements and have no instruction from the Department of Justice, no telephone numbers for me to call, which concerns me. You know, my question is, are they truly concerned with the parents who they serve when there is no instruction as to what these papers mean, what they are for, what timelines you can expect? There are no questions. There's no number for questions. And I can't, because of the financial disaster of my illness, I can't get long distance. I can't get through to the Department of Justice with any questions. And I'm a fairly bright person. But that's been a problem. Now, getting back to page 14, the wording where it says it would be helpful to practitioners to put the law this way, I think that's kind of telltale. I think they're looking more at helping the child support practitioners than they are at helping the parents who are seeking the support.
So you understand, though, before us today, we're not changing or writing the rules. What we're dealing with is the bill and the wording of the bill that's before us.
Right, and I'm sorry that I digress. So basically my point is the payments that I've made towards Social Security and disability when I was able to work have produced the support that my daughter gets and through SSDI. That support was paid for by me in the form of premiums. That support is received specifically for the child, not from me. And to me, that's a pretty clear picture as to how that money should be counted when looking at child support.
So you do support the bill?
So I do support the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, I support the dollar for dollar amendment.
Bobby, you go ahead.
Okay. My name is John Roach, and I live in Beaverton, Oregon. This bill came about because I am a divorced father. I have been a salesman for 30 years, traveling salesman, sold floral supplies. I became disabled. I had health problems, and I was current with my support until I became sick. I filed for Social Security disability. I should have passed out a few things, I guess. I was awarded Social Security disability almost 2 years later, going through a very difficult process. At that time, I accumulated almost $4,900 in arrearages in support. When I was awarded disability, it was retroactive from the time I had filed, which was almost 2 years back. My children received, because of my disability, almost almost $15,000, and it was not accredited or counted as support. Now, my attorney was the attorney that was in Vancouver, and he was the one also, a friend of his who was in Vancouver, was the one who was a disability specialist who handled my disability case. As soon as I received my award,
He filed a motion with the Oregon court to recognize this. Washington State recognizes Social Security disability benefits paid to a child by a disabled parent for a dollar-for-dollar count. I was paying $400 a month in support, plus $42 a month for insurance, which is separate in the decree, and also half of all unpaid medical bills. My children now receive $650, $58 a month, Social Security benefits, which is more than what I was ever paying before. I had to go back to court in the middle of this process to lower it. I'm still currently paying $168, and that might not sound like a whole lot. When I made good money, it wasn't a whole lot to me. But it's a good part of my disability check because I still pay $42 a month, which is for insurance, which is part of support, half of all unpaid medical bills, which my children are now looking at braces, which is going to be another $100 or so. I think that those also forms of support. And I'm asking that this bill be passed so the state will recognize the benefits that a child receives as a result of a disabled parent, that disabled parent receive credit for that. I also would like to make a statement dealing with the fact that from the first meeting we had dealing with this bill in the House, I was not there for the workshop, but from what I understand, they take the parents' both figures together and add them up. They now put Social Security over on the side. They subtract that benefit, and they come back down to the bottom and figure the percentage. That might sound good, but my income is low, and if theirs are high, it raises it up and puts me in a disabled person in a very bad disadvantage. There's one thing I wanted to say I can't remember, and I apologize, but I
think of it later will allow you to add it to the
report. I thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank Mr. Witt for his hard effort on this for my behalf and the other people which are going through the same situation and problem, and I should have passed these out to you, and I forgot to do that. That was...
So we can also have those pass on that. Yes, Senator Duncan?
I just found the Senator Hartshaw.
Thank you.
The other thing I wanted to mention, Mr. Chair, if I can mention it now, I'm sorry, was the fact that it went in and went out so quick. I'm sorry. I was going to say the dollar for dollar issue. I understand what that means, and I think a father should support his children. I believe that very heavily. I've always tried to be there for my children emotionally, financially, and recognizing the Social Security. Disability is based not on income. It's based on the ability to work. Do I have the ability to put in the 8 to 10 hours a day like I used to or not? If I was a millionaire, I could still get disability, because it's based on my ability to work. The dollar-for-dollar ratio for a lower-income person would allow them credit, and if I had stocks and bonds and other investments and monies coming in, well, I certainly would pay the overage. But I think the Social Security should at least be accredited as a dollar-for-dollar in fairness because of the disability.
Thank you.
And I thank you for your time.
That's our job. Absolutely.
Well, Mr. Chair, distinguished senators, at this time I'd like to reserve my comments a little bit because I would like to hear from the Department of Human Resources. I'm a lot confused on their guidelines, and I think we need some answers. I'm also confused in what the letters that they are writing to the representatives. And then they send me another letter saying just the exact opposite. I'd like to hear from them first what they have to say. But I think this bill is needed, and we need some clear-cut definitions of disabilities and whose money is to be used for what. The guidelines that we have here in 1999 state that they're used to be just for the children.
is they're giving us credit. And that is not happening. I just had my hearing on May 1st of this year, and I got no credit for my disability payments made upon my behalf. I was married for 3 years. My divorce started in 1989. I'm still going through this settlement process. My ex-wife has been receiving benefits on my behalf since the very beginning of this thing, which averages out to $500 a month. I'm just going to get a general figure. They are actually right now they're getting $566. But just for ease of figuring, over the last 10 years, my ex-wife has been paid over $60,000 in child support, and I think I passed out something up there that says shows on my behalf for my benefits of disability. And I got no credit for this whatsoever. And yet, they say they're being fair in the guidelines, and I believe also I passed up my divorce papers here that were just sent to this month. And what they are actually doing, they are using my case as case law in the state of Oregon, and Mr. Roach here also got hit by this thing using my case law. We had a judge come back here in 1990, Judge McCombo, and he said, because you are disabled, you don't pay any taxes, and therefore we're going to go ahead and we're going to add 30% to your income, and we're going to lower your wife's by $1,000, so I raised my income by $2,000, and lower hers by $1,000. I said, now we're going to figure the percentages, which is not something in the guidelines here, which comes out that I owe 67% of the thing, and yet in the guidelines it specifically states gross income is disability payments or Social Security payments. So the guidelines are not being adhered to. And the way we're doing it here is saying that in this bill, I should be given credit for those payments. And the reason we want them retroactive, even this order here now that they came out with this last one in May, by the way they figured it here, I owe $841 a month in child support. On top of that, she gets the other $556. That's $1,407 a month. I don't get that kind of money. And that's the way they're doing it. Because they're totally disregarding that income. It says in the court order, we recognize it, but nobody gets any credit for it. And not being given credit yet every month, until my children turn 24 years of age, I'm going to go into arrears because they have taken more than the federal government allows to be taken out of my disability payments as a garnishment. I believe I think I also sent some documentation up there that shows that they're taking 60% of my veterans benefits, and they are taking 50% of my disability payments from Social Security. The document that I believe I handed up there. I'll have to back that up. And one, this is where I need to talk to the Department of Human Resources, because we, or Mr. Witt, Representative Witt, had received a letter from them, from the Department of Justice, from Grinnell Shankle, and I do believe she's here.
And she's also signed a petition.
Yes. And she states right in the first paragraph, we determined that in particular fact in Mr. Hoyman's case, is not veterans' benefits going to the children but Social Security benefits. And yet there's a statement right up there that I handed out. 60% of my veterans' benefits are going in there. I guess what her intent is, they don't want to include veterans' benefits. They don't want to get credit for veterans' benefits. And I think they also said here they did a study. And that's on the second page of this, the Department of Justice memo. My Social Security benefits, veterans benefits for the dependents are paid as part of the total veteran award, whether or not the veteran is living with the dependents. And they were claiming that it was hard to figure out payments, and then you can hand it up here, very clear cut. It's a simple target that you get to each child. It's not that hard to figure out. But what they also don't say is because I am 100% disabled, when my children turn 18, Social Security benefits stop for the children. But because I am disabled 100% through the Veterans Administration, they pick up payments for my children to go to school. They reduce my payments, my own payments, by $180, and I have a daughter that's in college right now under this particular bill. And she gets $400 a month. So in other words, the essence is $580 a month per child. But according to the way the guidelines are written now, I'm going to be going into arrears, and I won't get any credit for this. Now, that's the thing. When my, these two children I have now, they're 15 and 12 years of age. I won't get any credit for any of that. These payments made on my behalf. And I believe I also submitted, I think personally, each one of you about a letter of trying to clarify our point. The Court of Federal Regulations, that the CFR 404.368A1 specifically states that the you are receiving child support if you are getting money from a person's Social Security. Have you got that, Sean?
Yes, I have it right here. You read that. I don't know if that was passed out. I thought I brought it up, but I think
we have it. That's what it states. The insured person is making a contribution for your support if you receive an allotment, allowance, or benefit based upon his or her military pay, veterans pension or compensation or Social Security earnings. And that's pretty clear cut for the federal regulations, and that's why that particular thing was set up in the first place, is to help the disabled person make payments. They understand that we can't work. In my case, I've had the bachelor's 5 times. I cannot go back to work again. I have numerous other disabilities.
But let's do this then. We're not going to be able to go into work session on this today. We have two other witnesses. What I'd like to do is invite from the Department of Justice, Arnell Shankle to come forward, and also from the District Attorney's Office here in County, Carl Stecker, and we'll take their testimony today. Committee, I did promise we would adjourn at 3 o'clock, and I still intend to accomplish that. So if they would come forward, please.
Mr. Chair, can I say one thing?
Yes.
I would like to say one thing on the back of that thing dealing with the Oregon scale of child support obligations. The percentage, when it gets into the 25% bracket, is one where the people have lower income and it's a very heavy burden. But if you go to the very back page, if a joint couple is making $15,000 a month, the percentage drops down to only 13%. You think the more money a person had, the more they can help their children in the scaling of this. It seems like an imbalance in the way it's set percentages. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. Thank you. Dennis and Carl, who it goes. I guess everybody's supposed to know who they are. I'm about to find out. Everyone, start.
For the record, I'm Ron L. Sankle with the Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division, here today speaking on behalf of the state agencies within the Child Support Program, both the Department of Human Resources, where the Director's Office resides, and the Support Enforcement Division. We're here today neutral on this bill and to explain to you that the Angros version has 3 basic concepts found within it. The first concept is the one that deals with the basic concept of considering Social Security benefits received on behalf of the child as a result of a parent's disability or retirement. This issue actually came up as part of a guidelines advisory process, and there was a group of people, both program staff, attorneys from the private sector, members from advocacy groups such as Oregon Legal Services, all represented on this committee. We spent quite a great deal of time talking about the issue, and the result was the Oregon Administrative Rule 405, which is the handout that I gave you. It's just a piece out of that larger guideline set, and an approach to consider Social Security benefits as a routine part of any child support calculation. That did not exist in Oregon's guidelines prior to March 1st. That rule was just effective March 1st. So that is in place. The amendments to this bill, in essence, mirror what we had done in rulemaking and would put that into statute. The second concept has to do with change of circumstance modifications, and the A and Gross version, again, was amended and speaks to the fact that if someone has a child receiving Social Security benefits as a result of retirement or disability, that would be grounds for a change of circumstance modification, because this new rule is in place and we would be able to apply it. The third concept talks about allowing a credit for retroactive benefits, and it would give rulemaking authority to the program so that we could set out rules. And our logic there, again, was we would like to bring together a group that represents the various interests and determine the most effective way to apply that credit that benefits all of the family members involved in a particular calculation.
You also have before you today the, I believe, A3 amendments that were submitted on the House side. It contained one additional word that we had requested be taken out of Section 3, the word before, and Legislative Council has confirmed for me that they just inadvertently missed that word, so that's why the amendment was brought forward on this side. And that is important to us because going back and applying this new bill, should it become law, to orders that have already been entered, could cause some legal issues. There are orders out there where people have stipulated the certain amounts, and by saying this law comes in and automatically changes that would cause some legal concern. So we believe it is more appropriate to have a law from the date of the bill or the law forward to apply these new remedies. The constituents have spoke to you about various issues regarding dollar-for-dollar credit on Social Security benefits and also about veterans' benefits. And they pointed to the same page in the guidelines that I was going to refer you to, which was the page 14. And in there, we spoke to what the advisory committee had done and talked about the fact that we do agree there should be a systematic approach to handling Social Security benefits and something laid out for practitioners to use. Our advisory committee's recommendation rejected the dollar-for-dollar credit because that approach doesn't enhance the overall well-being of children. In Oregon, we use a combined income model for our guidelines. We take into account both the mother and the father's income, in essence, and do a calculation to determine what support that child would be eligible for if that family was still intact. That's the underlying premise of our guidelines and the way that we approach it. Because we use that kind of model, doing a pure dollar-for-dollar credit on only one side of the equation is not always an equitable approach. Sometimes it harms the custodial parent, and sometimes it harms the non-custodial parent. So the advisory committee felt that the approach in our rule, which is mirrored in the Angus version, is a more equitable approach overall for families. I'd also say to you that in doing our research, we looked at what other states have done, and many other states have reached the same conclusion that a dollar-for-dollar credit is not consistent with this income-based model where we have a combined income. The approach gives a child, a separated parent, the benefit of only Social Security disability payments when a child whose parents remain together still has the support of both parents as well as those benefits. And for that reason, many other states like Oregon have made the recommendation that it should not be as simple as a dollar-for-dollar credit. I have at the table with me our Assistant Attorney General, Jean Fogarty, who was involved in a great deal of the research. Should you have questions for her, I know that Mr. Stecker is going to speak to some of the other issues.
Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Carl Stecker. I'm in the Marion County District Attorney's Office, and I've been in charge of the Family Support Division of that office for the last 17 years. My statements to you today are also on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. First and foremost, we have to recognize that child support is set considering the income and circumstances of both parties. And fundamentally, I beg to differ with the statement of law given by the earlier witness with respect to veterans' benefits and Social Security. They are very different species. Social Security is benefits for a child are supplemental to the award to the disabled party. So that basically there is no harm or prejudice to the recipient of the Social Security Disability Award. Their income is not impacted by the child's receipt of a derivative benefit. It's paid on top of the award to the parent. However, in veterans' disability instances, the award is, in fact, a cutout. It's an apportionment of the award, meaning that the veteran's award can be reduced and a portion of it directed to the dependent. And there is a very different treatment, therefore, by the federal government of both of these awards, and they cannot be, in fact, considered separately. So we just had an opportunity to see the A2 amendments today, but we'd be opposed to the A2 amendments, the inclusion of veterans' benefits in this scheme. Secondarily, I wanted to, and I thought it would be important, obviously, circuit courts act with the benefit of due process to both parties and both parties having a full opportunity for a hearing. One of the earlier witnesses alluded to his particular case, which was not handled by one of the agencies. Both parties were represented by private counsel. But I think it's instructive to note that the circuit court judge, Judge West in this instance, took into account the substantial income that the witness in fact enjoyed from both veterans' benefits as well as disability benefits. And those, the combined income from those two sources was over $3,500 a month tax-free. Witness didn't tell you also that part of the judge's consideration in rebutting the presumptive dollar amount in that case was the fact that the witness had received the party's home with a equalizing judgment or lien to the other party, which he then basically avoided in bankruptcy. So the judge made all these findings in fact as part of the opinion, which was filed April 30th, 1999, and certainly the witness has certain rights to appeal. He's already visited the Court of Appeals in the past. Certainly that's a more appropriate remedy in this case, where a judge has the opportunity to hear all sides fully and impartially and can render a decision, rather than to in effect adopt an approach here that only hears one side of a story, and admittedly one which is probably not fully representative of all facts. Finally, we are in support of the Dash-A3 amendments. They are very important that we recognize that a dollar-for-dollar offset that's retroactive, if it's granted, should not impact certainly any arrearage that's accrued for periods beyond the date of the award. Let's imagine an individual has 10 years' worth of back support and gets a retroactive award that is significant and covers the last 18 months. That any credit that would then be applied should certainly not wipe out the 10 years' worth of arrearage. It should not count against those periods of time for which support accrued and no payments were made when the individual was not disabled, had the ability to work and to earn. Thank you. Any comments I'd be glad to entertain?
Senator Brown would like to ask a question.
I'm confused. You support the dollar-for-dollar credit, but you don't support it okay.
No, I think I misspoke myself. I do not support the dollar-for-dollar credit. I'm saying that a dollar-for-dollar credit would be inappropriate in certain examples. We are opposed to the dollar or any retroactive credit because basically it undermines the modification process.
Okay. The
parties basically...
The change of circumstances? Okay.
Sure. Parties basically who sleep on their rights could then come in at a later time and say, I want a credit, when they could have certainly gone before the court or a tribunal or agency and requested a modification sometime earlier. And so in that sense, it works a retroactive modification and a hardship on the other party.
Mr. Chair?
Sure.
I assume that would be sort of an administrative nightmare in terms of, I don't know what proportion of your cases are Social Security Veterans Administration based, but I'm assuming you would have a majority of those folks coming in saying they want a credit for this.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, that is correct. We would assume that were a retroactive award ability made available, that there would be a pent-up demand, there would be a number of individuals who might qualify for such relief or seek it. And one of the dilemmas with certainly that is then to determining the exact period of time for which the award would cover and perhaps some kind of limitation so that only the support that accrued during the period of the award would be creditable.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Brown, if I might add to that, one of the amendments in the third section went in and changed to allow us rulemaking to deal with those cases where it is appropriate to allow credit for past support, because it was not the fault of the parent that they did not receive the award, but simply we know Social Security benefit determinations often take several months. And that's why we recommended the word may, so that it could be done in those cases where it was appropriate, but wouldn't be abused in other cases where it was not. Thank you.
Sure. I just want to make sure I understood you clearly. You would think that the treatment for Social Security benefits would be a good idea.
Yeah, I got to go to the Missouri office.
But you would oppose the treatment for veterans benefits because of the different way they're taken out of the different way the formula works.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, we have no opposition, certainly, to factoring in the Social Security Disability Award in the award of the child support. Certainly, the scheme that's been adopted by the Child Support Guidelines Advisory Team was the most equitable one that we could fashion. And it was one that considered the impact on both parties, in fact. And it's just been on the books since March 1st, so it's relatively new. But as to veterans' benefits, yes. We have assisted some of our applicants, some of our constituents with application for veterans' benefits apportionment. And what we've discovered is that the Veterans Administration has a very, very high threshold. We had an individual, a custodial parent who had about $1,200 a month income, and veterans denied an apportionment in that award because they said $1,200 a month income is, you make too much money to get a part in this veterans benefit.
Chair Courtney and Senator Burdick, if I may add to that, the correspondence, when this issue was raised on veterans benefits, we informed Representative Witt that we would do some research because we had not addressed that in our guidelines review. And the correspondence that we sent to him did indicate that our recommendation as far as our rulemaking would be not to add veterans benefits as a standard calculation in the way that we did the Social Security benefits. In two different contacts made to the Veterans Administration, we were told that there is not a simple chart that is applied to all cases, but it differs from case to case. But we have made a recommendation, and we are going forward with the process, to explain in our guidelines commentary to practitioners that when veterans benefits are being received on behalf of a child, that should be considered within our rebuttals to the guidelines. It's not a standard routine calculation that we can easily grab in all scenarios, but it should be considered when it is appropriate. So we are not completely ignoring the issue, but we don't think it mirrors the Social Security benefit method.
Anybody else? Well, thank you. Okay. I'm going to start with the members because I guess
you said when we are.
Yeah, we're supposed to start at 10. We're not going to work today. We're just going to.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to respond to Mr. Secker and Thankless Secretary for a while. Again, I have a problem with the Department of Justice and my son Robert both here. They say in this letter to Mr. Witt that I can go ahead and have my relief from Mitchell Lemon is currently available under the March 1st guideline, support guidelines. And as you recall, my worst case that came up was in May, after these guidelines were here, and they were not used. And this is the letter I get from Mr. Stecker saying Mr. Lehman may be eligible for a period of review modification after April 2001. We're not getting the same story. And the same thing he goes in here, says, if I'm not happy with a judgment that came down, I can file an appeal. And which I did do, but he's not giving it any credit. He's saying because of other past deaths. Those things were never even discussed in this last year. And that's why I'm on appeal for it. But you've been saying one thing to Mr. Witt, saying I can get relief under the current guidelines, and I'm not. And that's the letter that comes to me, saying you cannot get relief until 2001. Maybe they refuse to review. And we do need some relief for those benefits that are being paid upon our behalf. For our children. That's why Social Security shut that benefit up for to take care of the child for us, which comes out in the court of federal regulations. I mean, we got $60,000 in my case that went to my ex-wife, and I got no credit for any of it. And for the next, until my children are 24 years old, I'm going to go into arrears every single month because they're taking more now than the federal government allowed them to take on my apartment benefits. Every month, now until my children are 24. So that means I'll be paying until the children are 30 years old. I can't give any more because they've already taken. That's why we need some kind of recognition for the benefits that we're getting. And they're clearly not being reserved to. My case is after this new guideline, and they're not using it again. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. The public hearing on House Bill 2361 is closed, and the committee is adjourned. Oh, thank you, Representative Witt. Thank you. Thank you.